I think a lot of times question comes up about the why so much meditation with images in the Tibetan tradition. I mean, for example, if you were doing Zen Buddhism, or if you were practicing one of the Theravada traditions, which are now mostly in Southeast Asia, you would not particularly be meditating with images. Although it was a very common practice throughout Asia, including Southeast Asia and China and whatnot, for a long period of time. And it was a technique that pretty much only survived in Tibet. And a lot of that has to do with the history of Buddhism in Asia, about what traditions survived in what ways and what locations. And so now, from a modern point of view, we don't tend to see the whole pattern unless you're trained as a scholar. So you see the history and see that the kind of Buddhism that's practiced in Tibet was practiced in Indonesia at one time, for example. But you wouldn't know that, you know, if you went to Indonesia, for certain, because it's now it's a Muslim country, which so you wouldn't see any Buddhist practice at all. But it was also practiced in Southeast Asia and in China. You wouldn't see it there either. So I think that the best way for me to answer, to get at why meditation with images and why the Tibetans stress that and why it's important and why it's efficacious, is to, again, to put on my sort of religious scholar hat. If you look at religions all over the world, you see there tends to be a kind of a tension between sort of a personal view of religion and an impersonal view of religion. That a lot of people feel that a religious life without a kind of personal relationship with a higher power is a little bit of a problem for them, because that kind of abstraction is not comforting to them. Whereas other people are just the opposite, that, you know, the whole idea of God as a person, which then in their mind sometimes turns into an old man with a long white beard sitting on a big chair someplace, you know, that really turns them off. And so that you have personal preference in all of this. But if you look into all the religious traditions, and you look into the scholarship in all the religious traditions, they all deal with this particular question. And in many cases, the scholars would say, look, human beings have this sense of I, this sense of self, the sense of I'm a person. And it's something that's deeply written in their characters. And because of that, that's a very powerful impulse. It's a very powerful way in which human beings understand the world and see the world through a personal lens. If you get right down to it, most people see the world through a personal lens. I mean, there might be nuclear physicists that don't, but even under those circumstances, I'm not sure. I think people tend to see the world in a personal sense. They certainly see it through the filter of I, or person. So what the technique with images really does is it takes that characteristic. Hi, come on in. Takes that characteristic of our personifying things and uses it in a kind of a functional way, if you will. So in Vajrasattva practice, we're working with a specific kind of an image. And that raises another set of issues for people, because you have a male and female image in a kind of embrace with each other. And then depending upon your attitudes towards such things, you can go off in a lot of different directions about what you imagine all of this stuff means. And probably most of the directions in which your mind would naturally go are viewed by the scholars of these kinds of practices as having nothing to do with what the practice is about. That it only has to do with the way your mind works. It doesn't have anything to do with what the practice is about. Which is not at all helpful, really, if that's what's occurring to you, because it doesn't answer any questions at all. But nevertheless, that's what they would have to say. So if you look at Vajrasattva, which is a very, very old Vajrayana practice, and I'm going to use that word and not Tibetan, because the practice originates in India. And the practice originates in India 300 or 400 AD. No one knows for certain, but it goes pretty far back, and it is Indian in origin. So to say it's Tibetan only speaks to the last 1,000 years or 800 years, rather, of its lineage. It's really not a Tibetan practice. It's actually an Indian practice, and the best way to refer to it is Vajrayana, which means the path of the Vajra. And so here we have Vajrasattva. So Vajrasattva means the being that's made of Vajra nature. And so what is Vajra nature? If you look at the image, it's an image of a male and female embracing. And there's a symbolism to this, which, I mean, Carl Jung would say only modern people would see such a thing and say, well, it's a symbol, rather than see it as a numinous or a spiritual reality. And he would say that's how impoverished the 20th century is. So you can imagine how impoverished the 21st century is, if the 20th century was impoverished. But the male-female embracing represents the coming together of the essential nature of our existence. I mean, on that level, if you think about what we are as beings, we're beings who exist because a man and a woman came together. And because of our own attitudes towards sexuality, we have all kinds of weird problems with that. But from an ontological point of view, the essence of what we are as a being is because of two beings that have come together. That's actually a great thing, but we have some weird stuff about that. The essence of our being as a spiritual being, if you will, from the Buddhist point of view, is that we are a being which is a spacious mind, which has characteristics of what are usually translated as bliss and voidness or emptiness, or joy or beatific experience, and the wisdom of what's real. That would be another way to say this, but that's a mouthful, so bliss, voidness will have to work. So I've done a lot of conversation in this house over the last couple of years about the meaning of voidness, and I don't want to say a whole lot about it this evening. I'll just refer you to some of the recordings that I've made, but I will say a little bit about it because there's some people here who are new, and so I need to introduce the idea. But basically, what the Buddhist tradition is saying is the essence of yourself as a person is joyful, energetically joyful, beatifically joyful, if you want to use that kind of language. And in that mind, which is beatifically joyful, you have the ability to naturally see what's truly going on. And what's truly going on is that everything is impermanent, everything is constructed by your own mind, everything operates on the basis of the law of cause and effect, but we tend to not like to think that everything operates on the basis of cause and effect. We actually natively like to think that all kinds of other things are going on. But in fact, Buddhism is founded on the idea of cause and effect, and that was the Buddha's main teaching. If you were to take an introductory religion class at the university and some professor was telling you about the basics of Buddhism, they'd say, well, the first thing the Buddha taught was the Four Noble Truths, which is life is not happy. There is a reason why life is not happy. There's a reason why life could be happy, and this is how to make life happy. It's usually that's called the Four Noble Truths, and but traditionally the way they teach it is life is suffering. There's a cause of suffering, there's a way of ending suffering, and then there's a path to end suffering. That's okay, but it's kind of gloomy. It's just as easy to say, we're not happy. Dalai Lama always starts his talks by saying, everyone has a right to be happy. We're not happy. What's the problem? That works better for Americans. I think it probably works better for everybody. So, you know, fundamentally, in some way, we're not happy, and we want to be happy. I mean, and if we're honest with ourselves, for the most part, I think we would agree with that. I mean, there are times when we're happy, but then there are plenty of times when we're not happy. But the Buddhist point of view is that there's no reason why you shouldn't be happy 24/7, because the essence of what you are as a being is a joyful characteristic, which is just joyful in its nature, which means it's joyful 24/7. We've lost that somehow. How did we lose it? Well, because we've lost it, it's hard for us to recognize that that's actually our nature. It's like, that sounds like a revelation? Or isn't that odd? Or why should I believe that? It doesn't accord with my experience. Well, of course it doesn't accord with your experience, because your experience is based upon all kinds of strange notions about what's going on, many of which don't have much to do with reality. We know that what exists and what we think exists are often two different things. Oddly, I had a meeting with my provost on Tuesday, who, because I was in a kind of an odd state for a variety of reasons, when he launched into this whole conversation about things aren't what they appear, and I'm still not sure why he did that, I'll have to ask him someday, I thought, oh, that's true. Why is he saying this? You know, but it's true. Things are not the way they appear. We have all kinds of ideas about what's going on that sometimes we're right, but most of the time we're not right. You know, especially when it's a matter of dealing with other people. Mostly, what we think is going on with other people is not what's going on with other people. Mostly, what we think is going on with other people is really our own minds projecting things onto other people, and that's what we think is what's going on. So, I mean, that's pretty interesting. You can learn a lot about yourself if you stop to think that mostly what you think is about other people is actually about yourself, but that's extremely discomforting. So we don't do that. Anyhow, that's a side trip. How am I getting? I'm going to have some trouble staying on target tonight, I guess. Okay, so Buddhist proposition. The essence of what we are is beatific joyfulness. Just happiness for no particular reason. It's just in our nature to be happy. Nothing else is required. And our nature is also wise and has the capacity to actually see what's going on. And in the Buddhist sense, that's called the wisdom of emptiness, which is recognizing that everything is impermanent and transitory, which is something that makes us unbelievably uncomfortable, which is why we get into all this mess of not seeing what's actually going on. Everything is based upon cause and effect, which also makes us uncomfortable, because we don't really want to believe that I'm the author of all my own problems. It's much easier to blame fill in the blank than oneself. And it's also the case that we really don't want to believe that pretty much everything we think is going on out there is just our own projection, our own construction. And that's a necessity, because our minds construct reality. We don't actually experience reality. You know, I mean, what happens is there are things that happen through our sense organs, but we ignore most of, I mean, physiologically, psychophysiologically, we ignore this from our own science. We ignore most of the information that comes to us through our sense organs, and then we organize whatever else we do not ignore into certain patterns of meaning, which are based upon experience, as Buddhists would say, karma or samskaras, habit patterns, or based upon language, or social conditioning, or our desires. Because I'm interested in something, I pay attention to it. Right now, I'm paying a lot of attention to Irish Crystal on eBay. You know, it's like there's something going on in my world because of my interest in it. You know, up until a few weeks ago, eBay was not part of my reality. Right now, it's sort of organizing my life in a certain interesting way, and I'm kind of wrestling with what's going on, you know, and all this just sort of popped out of no place, but it's part of my reality now. So those three things, that everything is a matter of cause and effect, that everything is impermanent, and that everything we experience is constructed, those three things are the three reasons why Buddhists say everything is empty or devoid. What's it devoid of? It's devoid of the characteristics it appears to have. Because everything appears to be solid, impermanent, and just out there, which is totally not true. Okay. So, when you have settled into the beatific nature of your own mind, so you're not busy being distracted by all the stuff that's going on out there, like eBay, then you can see what's going on out there, which is nothing in particular. Because there's just this stuff flying by, which, if you're not attached to it, just flies by, and that's just fine, because then you can just sort of hang out in your own happiness. But we don't do that, because we're really more fascinated by the stuff that's flying by, and therefore we miss our own happiness while we're busy chasing happiness after all the stuff that's flying by, which goes by before we can grab it, and therefore we're not very happy. So we're all familiar with this process. This is not anything new. We just don't tend to stop and think about it very much. Okay, back to Vajrasattva. So what's with Vajrasattva? So Vajrasattva is the personification, if you will. It's the visual personal imagery of that bliss and voidness, in which the male side is the bliss side and the female side is the voidness side. Okay, Vajrapakuti represents the wisdom of emptiness, and Vajrasattva, the male side, represents the beatific state. Now, that might come as a surprise to some people that Buddhists would organize it that way, but the Buddhist tradition is that, as far as gender symbolism is concerned, female aspect represents wisdom, male aspect represents beatific experience. Is that a question? No? Okay.
Makes perfect sense.
Okay. So, when you're meditating Vajrasattva, you could be meditating this male and female sitting on your head, white light, and all this kind of stuff. Or you could be meditating bliss and voidness conjoined, reality of my own nature. That's what's radiating this beatific light. So you can also practice when Vajrasattva and you become one. You can also practice I'm Vajrasattva and my nature is that beatific unity, the unity of that beatific quality and the wisdom of emptiness. So the practice starts with it's outside of yourself, and the practice ends with I'm it. And that's very typical of Buddhist practice, because we start out by thinking wisdom is out there, joy is out there, rather than, no, that's my nature. So first we've got to find it, because we don't know it's there, and then when we find it, we can say, oh, that's me. Okay, so then that's the symbolism, if you will, of Vajrasattva entering into yourself, is that joining. And it's simply a recollection, in fact, of your own true nature, which is to be beatifically happy and to know what's really going on. But of course we've forgotten all that stuff, and that's why we have to practice the recollection of it. So that's one aspect of Vajrasattva practice. What I can say on the basis of my own experience is when you do that often enough and you do that strongly enough, and you really kind of hang out in this characteristic state of I am beatific awareness of emptiness, which is not nihilistic, because now we understand emptiness has a specific meaning here. Okay, it's not nothing. It's not something. It's beyond nothing or something. It's this other thing. That, to use language I used earlier. When we are practicing Vajrasattva and we really begin to recognize not just the symbolism of Vajrasattva, Vajrapakuti, beatific awareness, awareness of emptiness, when we don't so much see that as something we wish to achieve, but we hang out in that space of I am that long enough, then something will change. And what changes is the emptiness is no longer Vajrapakuti. The emptiness is this. And the bliss is no longer Vajrasattva. The bliss is this. And so for the sake of the recording, the first thing I did was point to the world. Voidness is the space around one. Everything in the space around one is the voidness of Vajrapakuti. And you experience that. You experience this space, world around yourself, as what you are embracing as Vajrasattva. You really can. And you can experience yourself as the beatific awareness which embraces that. And in time, that awareness recognizes that it's also empty. And so the embrace is with yourself most deeply, in the sense of you experience yourself as subject, as beatifically happy and utterly empty. And in the sense of utterly empty, as full of potential, full of non-obstructed space and mind. And that everything can flow through that without any particular impediment. So when you're sitting meditating in this way, it's actually very satisfying. And when the weird thoughts about eBay come up, if you have your act together even slightly, they just sort of show up and they float through your mind and then they go away. And if you notice that they don't, then you're noticing the process of attachment. And you're noticing what it is that would draw you away from that awareness. And if you get drawn away from that awareness in your practice, then you get drawn away from that awareness in your practice, and eventually you notice it, and then you have to haul yourself back and go through the whole thing all over again. That's human life. That's just the way it is. You do it. The alternative, of course, is that you just get led around by all that stuff flying through the space that, you know, attracts you. I mean, you know, I could sit on my computer staring at water for crystal on eBay hour after hour. How unwholesome would that be, you know? I mean, within limits, it's okay. And so it's a matter of finding where those limits are in that balance. But the same thing in meditation. You know, I can be distracted, and that's just the human condition. And I can let myself get up from my meditation cushion, or I can say, whoop, got distracted again. Come back to what's really, what am I doing here? Because I can spend time on the computer, and I can spend time meditating. And the deal, the wholesome deal, is to do one when you're doing one and the other when you're doing the other. I mean, Buddhists are not too big on saying don't do that thing. There are some things that are big on saying don't do, like don't steal, don't kill, don't slander, stuff like that. But they're not too big on saying don't have pretty things in your house. They are pretty big on saying don't get too attached to them. They're pretty big on saying don't have too many of them. But they're not big on saying don't have any. They're not big on saying pretty isn't a good thing. Because this is the world. And if you see it for what it is, it's all okay. The problem is only when you don't see it for what it is. Okay, there are other things about Vajrasattva symbolism. That's sort of the main element in regards to practice. Some of the other things about Vajrasattva symbolism, I don't want to talk about the Vajra because I talked about that some other time ago, but I will talk about what Vajra Prakuti is holding in her hands. Because if you remember what's in the sadhana, Vajra Prakuti is said to be holding a curved knife, which looks like that one up there. If you can't see it from where you are, you can see it later. And in the sadhana, a skull, but it's not really a skull. It's the top of the skull, but cut in half to be like a cup. Okay, so why would Vajra Prakuti be holding a curved knife in one hand and a skull in the other hand like this behind Vajrasattva's back? Well, again, what is the symbolism here? Tantric symbolism tends to not play nice. It tends to be very direct, okay? So what is the direct? Well, the curved knife, actually, traditionally in India, although it's called in English a chopper, it's not. It's actually a flailing knife, which is to say the kind of knife that you would use for taking the skin off of an animal. Okay, so why would wisdom be holding an implement which is used for taking the skin off an animal? It's because what is the skin? The skin is the appearance that covers the reality of what we are. Okay, so when Vajra Prakuti is taking the skin off of something, wisdom is revealing the truth behind the appearance. That's the symbolism there, at the level of symbolism. At another level, it's just that has a visceral impact, and I can't exactly explain why. That's the thing about symbolism. It stays within its own realm. It refuses to be rational. I mean, I can talk about the symbolism of Vajrasattva and Vajra Prakuti and sort of get at it, but there's some things that are harder to sort of get at, and that's one of them. But you can say that it represents the slicing away or the removing of appearance in a very visceral sense. Because remember, the subconscious mind is a symbol-using mind, and it is very visceral. Just think about your dreams, especially the ones that freak you out and wake you up. They're very visceral. And this is the world that Vajrayana symbolic practice gets into. It transforms that world, so it exists in that world, and it works with the symbols and the energies of that world. So curved knife. Skull cup. Why a skull cup? Well, imagine the top of your head and what's in the top of your head. Okay, what's in the top of your head? What is she holding in her left hand? The tradition is she's holding a bowl, skull bowl, full of beatific bliss. Okay, so the symbolism again is your head is full of bliss. Very direct. Your head is full of bliss. How is it possible for your head to be full of bliss? This refers to the practice with the inner winds and the inner energies that are mobilized or begin to move with Vajrasattva practice. When you're sitting in meditation and you're beginning to experience the nature of your own mind as beatific, what you begin to experience is the actual inner energetic system of your nervous system. I don't know any other way to explain this. You begin to experience the energies of your nervous system directly. And why not? I mean, your consciousness is of that character, and you begin to experience it. And that symbolism of the skull cup points to that inner experience of beatific bliss. So, having said all that, it can't probably conceivably make any sense at all, because why should it? But it's not arbitrary. It's actually very specific. And you could say, well, yeah, specific to the Indians, the Tibetans, why should that have any meaning to me whatsoever? Because I'm me, I'm a modern American, and you know, this comes from India of 1,800 years ago, or 1,400 or 1,600 years ago, and nobody is entirely sure. So I'll end my little talk with a story, because I had this question too. And I think I've told some of you this, so pardon me if I'm repeating myself. In the early 80s, I was in Dharamsala. I was doing some translating at the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives. And I was actually doing some translating in the Buddhist wisdom tradition. But because my background before I got into Buddhist studies was as a counseling psychologist, and I worked in community mental health for a number of years, I was always interested in the confluence of Buddhist practice and theory along with psychology and psychotherapy. So I had a mission in addition to my own translating, which was to interview the Dalai Lama for a psychology journal called the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology. And I did three meetings with him. And in one of those meetings, and I don't remember if it was the summer of 82 or the summer of 83, but anyway, in one of those meetings, I asked this particular question. Okay, so here's all this symbolism, but it's Tibetan symbolism. You know, why should it work for us? So this is before I'd gotten seriously involved in Vajrayana practice. I was, you know, doing some really hardcore Buddhist philosophy, and I wasn't doing, you know, Vajrayana practice at that time at all, in fact. So I was a little bit, you know, like, okay, what is this? Why would it work? You know, kind of thing. So I was sort of in the state of mind that a lot of people are in, I'm sure. And he said, well, this practice came from India. This is not a Tibetan practice. This practice came from India. Indian language is different than Tibetan language. Biologically speaking, Indians and Tibetans don't have any relationship to each other, neither do their languages. Their cultures are utterly different. But you know what? We've been doing this for the last 1,000 years and it works real well. So if it works for Tibetans and it's an Indian practice, trust me, it'll work for Americans too. I thought, well, he didn't quite phrase it that way, but that's more or less what he said. And I thought, yeah, okay, that settles that question for me. I'll just have to assume that it's going to work and try and figure out on my own, is it going to work or not? So that was now 83, 93, how many years ago was that? Almost 30 years ago. I can't believe that. It was almost 28 years ago. I can't believe that. So 28 years ago, that's what he told me. And shortly after that, I started getting interested in Vajrayana practice. Took a while, but I did. And I can't tell you why most of the symbolism works, but I can tell you that it works. So believe me or not, check it out for yourself. As the Buddhists always say, check it out for yourself. You know, if it works for you, great. If it doesn't work for you, forget it. You know, the Dalai Lama says that all the time. So that's my experience. And we'll continue to practice with Vajrasattva. And I almost forgot, what did Dzogchen Rinpoche tell me a week ago? So I said, Rinpoche, we've been doing this Vajrasattva practice, and also we've been very interested in what the Tibetans would call mind training, which is the cultivation of compassion. Yeah, that's one of the themes, as I said, of the year. So I know these connect with each other, and what we've been telling people is that the way to bring them together is to imagine Vajrasattva either on their heads or themselves radiating light, you know, with another person or persons around, and that is a mind training practice which cultivates compassion. And we talked about that, and he said, yeah, that's the right thing to do. actually, he said, when I asked him how to do it, he said, that's the way you do it. I didn't say, this is what we're doing, is that okay? I said, if we wanted to bring together Vajrasattva practice and the cultivation of compassion, how would that work? And he described it, and I said, oh good, because that's what we're doing. It's nice to find out when you're doing something that the Lama says it's the right thing to do. So, yeah, he said it's the right thing to do. He spent Saturday talking about 7-point mind training, as it's called in the tradition. And he was in Yakima, but he had a bunch of students around the world who wanted to listen to his teachings. So he took out a smartphone. He turned on the front-facing camera, plugged it into the wall so it wouldn't run out of power, turned on the phone, propped it up on a stupa, of all things, pointed at himself, and did his teaching, which he then live-streamed over his phone to whoever around the world wanted to listen, which turned out to be several hundred people. And that was recorded, and I can't track down the recording, but as soon as I do, I will post it on the website. So, yeah, so you can listen to his and see him teaching. And, of course, you know, it's a pinhole camera, so I don't have great expectations for the quality of the image. And I'm not quite sure about the sound, but I'm certain it's all good. A lot of people wrote in afterwards and said, thank you, Rinpoche. That was quite wonderful that we could have a live teaching while we were in Phoenix or Christchurch, New Zealand, or wherever they were, while you were in Yakima.
And maybe next time we'll know ahead of time. So if you actually want to listen to him live while it's happening.
Yeah. I guess you'll probably do that because it's pretty easy, you know. I mean, the live stream people were listening to, it was just at one point he forgot to push the record. When he ended the Friday night talk, he was doing it that way Friday night too, he forgot to push some button, and so it didn't record, it just streamed. But by Saturday morning he remembered, so it recorded. But I don't know where the URL is, I can't remember it. I'll send it.